We're doing our class on the Jewish home together with Pirkei Avot. And we were up to the fifth chapter of Pirkei Avot, the 17th Mishnah. You guys grew up in a home, so you know what it means to fight. Didn't I ask you to fill the gas last night so I don't have a car that's empty of gas when I got to go to work this morning? No, you didn't. Yes, I did. No, you didn't. Mm-hmm. But I did. No, you didn't. You think it's funny? What's funny? And now I'm stuck. I'm going to be late to work. We agreed. No, we didn't. But we did. You know how many arguments look like that? Didn't we agree that we wouldn't overspend on the credit card? Didn't we agree that this month we'd keep our cost intact because we're still paying off last month's bill? Of course we agreed. So why'd we go over? Well, mister, why don't you ask yourself that question? Why'd we go over? I did ask myself the question, and I know that I kept in line with our agreement. Really? You kept in line with our agreement? How come when you did the grocery shopping for Shabbos, I saw you bought extra drinks, you bought yourself that expensive whiskey? Wait a second. That whiskey cost 25 shekel. You went out and bought a dress for 1,000 shekel. Excuse me. You don't think you should be embarrassed that I'm going to shul with a torn dress on Shabbos? Of course I'm embarrassed you're going to shul with a torn dress, but it's a little tear that no one sees. Ah! So your whiskey's okay, but I'm supposed to go in rags to shul. If you've ever been in a home, you know that fights are prone to happen. Fights can sometimes be over little things, and other times they can be over little things. Usually they're over little things. It's rare that fights are about big things. We like to think they're about big things. Didn't I ask you not to yell at me in front of other people? Of course you asked me not to yell. I didn't yell at you in front of other people. So what'd you call that? We were standing in front of shul and you suddenly said to me, I've been waiting for you a half hour. What's going on here? The chulin's burning. Why did I work so hard to make the chulin? Is that fair to say that in front of other people? I didn't yell. But I did ask you for 25 minutes to leave the shul. Little things. And I say that most fights can be summed up with, no you didn't, yes I did, no you didn't, yes I did. Sounds babyish, sounds childish, but when you live with someone in close proximity, these things come up. And if you stop and look at them, you realize, hey, let's stop being children. So that could be the next step in the argument. Don't you think you're being childish? Don't you think you're being childish? Okay, very, very smart, right? What's the answer? The answer is the buck stops there. Here. The buck stops by us. Now, to the female members of our audience, I don't mean the guy has to stop the fight. I mean whoever is willing to take the credit of keeping the marriage the way it should be should stop the fight. And there's no rule about who should do it. The rule is that every person should strive to be the one to do it. It's not a guy thing or a girl thing. Every person has to take that responsibility. And if a person will say, but I'm always the one doing it. Good, so you'll get the shamayim, you'll have the credit that you saved the marriage. But I have a secret for you. In most marriages, most of the time, both spouses will swear that they're giving in 10,000% of the time. That you can't compare. That they're the ones that are always giving in more. I've never seen a marriage where both sides didn't feel that way. I could tell you a true story, one that's ongoing as we speak. This guy works two jobs. He works really hard. He comes home at about 7 o'clock at night. And then his wife is waiting with a splitting headache. And he's supposed to do the floor, do the dishes, make her supper, make the kids breakfast for tomorrow, put up lunch for the kids tomorrow because she has a splitting headache, and then clean up after all of that. At 12 o'clock at night, after he's done all of that, she's complaining she has a headache and he should give her a massage. And it's not fair because she's been suffering all night long from a headache and he hasn't done anything for her headache. And he's falling apart. He's been working hard all day. He comes home to his second job. And he can't expect to have supper waiting. That's not going to happen. He has to prepare everything for everyone else, including her supper. You know, the one thing she does is she feeds the kids. And you know what happens when the two of them sit down? She can speak for 3 hours straight about how inconsiderate and unappreciative he is. He is the worst husband in the world, and she wants a divorce. Oh, the sad part is that I haven't even told you the whole story. And she's insistent for years that he is so fortunate that she puts up with him because he has so little appreciation for everything she does. And she could sit here for 3 hours and tell you with a straight look and tears streaming down her cheek why he is the luckiest man alive and he has zero appreciation for all the things she does for him. And she doesn't see how she could continue putting up with him. And there isn't a night that she doesn't go to sleep crying and upset that she got dumped with such a bad catch and he is such a horrible husband and a horrible father. And I forgot to mention, in the morning he's got to take the kids out because she's still recovering from all the terrible things he did last night. And she will swear that she is the one that's keeping the marriage intact, and she believes it. Now, you understand that the same stories are true in the universe. There are many couples where the husband is a total brute and good for nothing, other than eating whatever his wife makes, and she's fielding the bills, working to keep everything intact, making the living, taking care of the kids, and he's meandering, walking around the streets, thinking how unlucky he is that he landed such a girl, and she's doing everything. And he'll swear that she is so lucky to have him. I've seen that too. And then there are all the cases in between where both sides are swearing that the other side is really lucky they haven't dumped him yet, but they're a great catch, and the other side is really tough to live with. And that's classical.
Are these Orthodox marriages?
It's every marriage. In every marriage...
Because at least they respect the sanctity of marriage enough. In secular spaces, they would probably split.
In every marriage. I'm saying that the nature of marriage...
would be more quick to leave, I think. There's a certain kedusha, I think. People will work harder, even if things aren't seemingly working. I'm guessing.
Okay, so I'm saying, but the nature of every marriage is that there will be arguments, and everyone knows how much they've given to make the marriage work. And everyone can look at their spouse and say, they don't do anything compared to what I do. Every one of us knows how much we've given in and how much we forego in order to make the marriage work. And how much we how many blows, in a figurative sense, how many things we're willing to take in order to make it work. And no one knows what the other side is fielding. So...
gotta hope that guy with the two jobs has a good work life. You gotta praise, appreciate it on the job. God, sorry, I gotta feel for him. Anyway, he told me this is a real guy.
This is a real story.
Story going on right now.
Bottom line, what the Mishnah we're about to discuss is speaking about a different type of argument. Meaning most arguments are stupid. And most arguments are because people aren't willing to accept that even if the other side isn't 100%, fine, I can swallow that. So we'll make it work. There are certain things I can't change. Let's make it work. The focus has to be on the positive, on what I appreciate, on what's good about this marriage, what's good about the other party. And that's always key. Because in every marriage, there are going to be points which really get on your nerves. There's no such thing as a marriage without it. So it's our choice, what we focus on. But then we come to real issues. The story goes back a decade and a half ago. 15 years ago, I wasn't yet married. I wasn't even dating yet. 16 years ago, okay? I wasn't yet dating, okay? 16 years ago.
So you were happy or you are happy?
And a friend of mine tells me he's contemplating divorce. So he's a decade and a half older than me. I mean, he must have been back then. Then he must have been in his 40s. So he's older than that. Two decades older than me. And I tell him, you're not allowed to get divorced. And he says, of course I have to contemplate divorce because I want to go live that time it was Gush Katif. I want to go live out in Gush Katif and places like that. I have so much to offer in the spiritual realm, and my wife insists on living in our villa, and she's not willing to budge from the villa I built her in the city, and it's not right. I don't have to work all day when I could lead a fulfilling spiritual life and have so much to offer Am Yisrael. It's not right that I should give up on all that, because she likes the amenity of city life, sitting in an established community. So I said to him, you are not allowed to get divorced. That's not an excuse. It's a cop-out. I know you have spiritual aspirations. Figure out how to meet those aspirations in another way. You do not trample on your wife and kids in order to attain spiritual growth. No, you cannot get divorced. So he said, you're wrong. I said, no, I'm talking to you from tradition. I didn't invent what I'm telling you. My tradition from my teachers is that before you're married, you look for a wife that matches on many levels. Once you're married, you say, if I have the minimum, if she's bringing up the kids right, and we live like husband and wife, everything else is perks. You don't break up a marriage because you have spiritual aspirations. That's great. Figure out how to meet those spiritual aspirations within the marriage. Don't destroy the home over that. So he said to me, you're wrong, and I'll prove it to you. I'm going to write a letter to Rav Aviner, and he's going to tell me I'm right, that I'm allowed to get divorced. I said, great. Don't get divorced before you write that letter. And let's see what he responds. So he sends the letter to Rav Aviner, and he gets a letter back. Rav Aviner says to him, the Talmud says, once you're married, if your wife is doing the minimum, she's bringing up the kids, and you guys are living as husband and wife, you have a normal amount of intimacy, everything else is perks. There's no way are you allowed to discuss divorce with her. So he comes back to me and says, how'd you know? I said, well, it's in the Talmud, but it's also my tradition. So that's the answer. But the truth is that the answer runs deeper. And that's where our Mishnah takes us. The Mishnah says, kol machloket shehi l'shem shamayim. When you have an argument that's for the sake of heaven, sofa litkayem. Its end, its goal is mutual existence. The goal of the argument has to be for productivity, for both of our continuum. The she'ina l'shem shamayim, and when we have an argument that's not for the sake of heaven, then in sofa litkayem, then the goal of the argument is not for the mutual benefit of both of us, it's not for continuum. If the argument is I'm going to win and you're going to give in and you're going to destroy your life, that's not l'shem shamayim. We had numerous stories of students who left Machon Meir, went to Chutz Laaretz, got married, and said, I must make Aliyah. And I'm always the bad guy, and I say, no. You must build your marriage, and as a couple, you have to come to that decision and make Aliyah. And the guy says, but I'm right, the halacha's with me, I learned in Machon Meir, I know I'm supposed to make Aliyah, I know I have to live in Israel. And then he starts quoting all the sources and bringing out printouts to his wife about what a bad person she is because she wants to finish her degree or doesn't want to leave her sick and ailing mom or a million other things. And he says, look, the halacha says, this is life. You can't live here in Chutz Laaretz. And if she's smart, she tells him to call me. And if he's smart, he says he won't. But maybe if not if he's smart. Is it l'shem shamayim? Is it really l'shem shamayim? An argument l'shem shamayim is sofa litkayem. Our goal is the mutual existence. Our goal is to make it work for everyone. When you pull out a halacha out of context and say, sure, we have to go. Yeah, in theory, in due time, together, without destroying your marriage over it and destroying your whole life over it. Make it work in a real way where it's litkayem. So your wife has an ailing mother, so you have to figure out what you're going to do about the mother. You can't just say, we got to go. She'll manage. There are good old age homes here. No. Figure it out together. See what's a normal compromise. See what can work. And maybe part of the solution is delaying Aliyah. Sometimes the correct answer is to postpone it. Yes, it's a sad thing to say. I don't wish it on anyone. I personally hate any day I'm out of this country. But sometimes you have to figure out what's lehit kayem. What's the way to make it that we both last, that both sides of the argument can last. So we began our discussion tonight with the regular petty arguments. But now we're moving on to arguments that sometimes have a lot of meat to them. That the argument is about things that sound like they're really the Shem Shamayim. And the Mishnah questions, Ezo machloket shi l'shem shamayim. And you have to ask yourself, why does the Mishnah have to ask that? Isn't it obvious which machloket is for the sake of heavens? And the answer is, no, it's not obvious at all. Let me tell you a true story. There was once a rabbi who was super pious. And he gave fantastic speeches and he had a huge following. And he had a long white beard and a big black hat and a long frock. And he was pushing agendas of reinforcing Torah observancy and Judaism throughout Israel. And his name was Korach. You heard of him? Korach, yes. So Korach wasn't the guy with a mohawk and a, you know, two earrings and tattoos on his right cheek and a patch on his eye. That wasn't Korach. Korach was a person who looked super pious. And when he gave speeches, he spoke about being super observant. And everyone can do it. And everyone has to get into this. And Moshe Rabbeinu, why don't you let everyone be spiritual and holy? He was pushing a holy line. The Mishnah says, you want to know what's a machlokas l'shem shamayim? I'll tell you a story. There was once a chief rabbi. And the guy just under him. And you'd think that's his competition. Hillel is the Nasi, and Shammai is the Av Beis Din. Shammai is the head of the courts. If Hillel gets bumped off, Shammai becomes the Nasi. You want to know what's a machlokas l'shem shamayim? Zo machloket Hillel v'Shammai. When Hillel and Shammai had an argument, even though theoretically Shammai was threatening Hillel, they were both rabbis over the same territory. Hillel was the Nasi, Shammai was just behind him. But that's a machloket for the sake of heaven. Their focus was, let's get to the truth. We're not looking to stomp one another out. We're looking to get what's right for the benefit of Am Yisrael. If it's sofalit kayem, if the point of the argument is for mutual existence, that's machloket l'shem shamayim. V'sheina l'shem shamayim, an argument that's not for the sake of heaven, so machloket Korach v'chol adato. Korach and his whole clan, they were preaching spirituality. It seems like they were very holy people. Right, but they were trying to stomp out Moshe. Look at where people are headed. Very often there are machlokot in shuls. You guys are going to see it, unfortunately. Sometimes a shul wants to kick out a rabbi. Sometimes a shul wants to ban someone from coming to shul. There are all kinds of arguments. In my little time that God has granted me thus far, I appreciate every minute, but I'm not that old yet. I've seen so many machlokot, so many situations where people came for the sake of heaven to kick out this rabbi, ensure that that person doesn't come to shul, ensure that that person doesn't get the seat he wants in shul. It's all for the sake of heaven. All things are for the sake of heaven. People will fight over the mechitza. People will fight over the seats. People will fight over the stender. People will fight over who sits on the eastern front. It's all for the sake of heaven. Yeah, come on. You're not going to honor so-and-so. And you're not going to honor so-and-so. And who's going to get Maftir Yonah? Is that, comes the Mishnah and warns us. You want to know what's the Shem Shamayim? Are we focused on both sides existing, succeeding, growing? Where's the focus? Or am I focused on one side getting what he wants? If that's my focus, that's not a machlok at the Shem Shamayim. You might say, but I'm in the right. Yeah, Korach was also in the right. No, he wasn't. But he seemed like he was in the right. He seemed more pious than Moshe. What was the line Korach was pushing? Everyone can be spiritual. Why hoard spirituality, Moshe? Everyone can be leaders. Everyone can be giants. So that seems like it works. No, it doesn't. Are you really for the sake of heaven? Is everyone going to dedicate themselves? Is everyone really going to do what they have to do in order to be fit to be a leader? Or are we going to have everyone doing what they want and destroying everything? So, it's hard to discern. And when we apply this Mishnah to our own marriages, I always say be very careful when it comes to spiritual arguments. I recommend taking the discussion out of the house. I recommend whenever there's an argument over something halachic or spiritual, you should have a rabbi that your wife feels comfortable with and you feel comfortable with, in that order. She has to be comfortable with it first, because at the end of the day, this is your realm to some degree. So she has to feel like the rabbi understands her and takes the time to hear. And then you both can go and consult. But when it comes to spiritual and halachic things, I think it's very important, especially for Chozrim B'Tshuva, but not only for Chozrim B'Tshuva. Take the halacha out of the house. I always say in my house, there's only one person that gives halachic ruling, and it ain't me. I don't give in my own house. People will call me with Shailas, and I try to answer. But when Shailas, when it comes up in my own house, I say, let's ask someone. Why should I give the halachic ruling in my own house? It's better that a person not give the halachic ruling in his own house. You can give rulings for other people, but for your own house, better let someone else answer. It's healthier. I know that the chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Avraham Shapiro, when he had halachic questions, he would ask. So the rabbi who he'd ask told over the story. He said Rabbi Shapiro called him up with his wife, called up with a question, and he was stunned. She called him up with some question of a pot or a pen. So he said, can I talk to your husband? So Rabbi Shapiro comes on the line. So the rabbi says, Harav, you know, I think that based on the Rebbetzin's question, I we could say because of A and B and C that it's okay. So Rabbi Shapiro said, yeah, I thought so too. But he wasn't going to say it. He referenced it out of the house. Chief Rabbi of Israel, right? Yeah, Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Harav. But when Halachic Shaila came up in his house, he told his wife, call Rabbi so-and-so. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say the name. Okay. There's nothing wrong with that. A person has to know that it's very easy to take the Shem Shamayim for the sake of heaven and use it to ram something down someone else's throat. And it's very dangerous. In one of our series on the Jewish home, the first class we had was the story we started tonight with. The story of Hillel having patience with his wife even though dinner was delayed an hour and a half. And we have to try and avoid situations where religious items become sources of conflict. I don't know of a chumrah that's worth an argument in the home. On the contrary, we have to know what's a chumrah and what's a halacha. But that's where, if you go to a rabbi that can take the time and understand where you're coming from, where she's coming from, hopefully they'll find a solution together with you. But I think the practical application of the Mishnah is that we have to be very concerned about ourselves when we think our argument is l'shem shamayim. You see, the Mishnah doesn't assume that it's obvious to discern when it's l'shem shamayim and when not.